Time to check out our place in space. Us, our, being Aotearoa, space being everything beyond the Earth's atmosphere. And here to discuss our place in space is space-based co-founder, space-based being a Christchurch-based space technology company, Emmeline Peart-Dahlstrom. Kia ora, Emmeline. Welcome back to Nights.
Kia ora, Brian, and thank you for having me. Happy Asteroid Day.
Happy Asteroid Day. Now, we are marking Asteroid Day today because, what, 114 years ago, something big crashed into Siberia?
Yeah, it's the Tunguska impact in 1908. Basically, it's probably, it's a 50 to 60 meter, I guess, house-sized asteroid that crashed sort of like into the forest of Siberia. So it wasn't a direct hit, because if it was, and if it was a city, it would have been like 12 megatons of explosion, which would have been devastating. Of course, we all know the more famous one, which is the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs like 65 million years ago. And that's a much bigger asteroid, of course, 10 kilometers across, and is really what we call a sort of like an extinction asteroid. I'm always fascinated about asteroids because it has like two parts, or basically two sides to it. One is that it could be, the cause of humanity's extinction, or on the other side of it, it could be the source of this abundant resources that we need for the foreseeable future.
Maybe it's both, Emmeline. But before we get into that, I actually, because it happened just a couple of days ago, and because we've spoken about this not too long ago, and that is Rocket Lab up on the Mahia Peninsula, or down, depending on where you might be in Aotearoa, launched a satellite which, as far as I understand, has got a consignment which is heading towards the moon, something the size of a stove. And we were talking about going back to the moon. What exactly did Rocket Lab launch, Emmeline?
Yes. So it's pretty historic, because as you can remember, you know, we had the Apollo program back in the 60s, which is to bring humanity to the moon. Now we're going back, and the program that they're calling is called Artemis. So it's the Artemis program, and this particular mission is the first of that whole program. And this small satellite that or spacecraft that was developed by Advance Space, which is a small company in the US, basically it's a precursor, and it's a way to determine where they would put the new space station that's going to be orbiting around the moon that is going to be populated by humans. So it's going into what we call a near rectilinear halo orbit. I know it's a mouthful, but essentially it's a very unique orbit around the moon, in such a way that the orbit of the satellite, it's always has 100% communication with the Earth.
And that could explain why you use the word halo, because from here on Earth, you might see, if you could actually see the orbit as a ring in the sky, it would be kind of above the moon, wouldn't it? Because you don't want it to go behind the moon, because once it's on the other side of the moon, we've lost touch with it, right?
Yes. Yeah, so that's really the main point of this particular mission. But what's really amazing about it as well is, the spacecraft plus the launch is about 30 million dollars, and to put that in context, the price of a ticket to go to the International Space Station for those private citizens going through the Russians is between 20 to 50 million dollars.
Where will this particular craft be now?
There's several stages. So first, it needs to get into orbit, and then it raises its orbit several times so that it gets to a point where it would get to a lunar insertion.
And it'll take, what, 2 or 3 days to get to a lunar orbit?
Yeah, well, it would take about 4 months, I believe.
Oh, really?
To get to.
So it's quite a bit slower than the Apollo, because the Apollo only took 2 or 3 days to get to the moon, didn't it?
Yeah, so that's also a much bigger rocket,
right,
as well.
So it's traveling quite a bit slower than the Apollo.
Yes.
But then that would explain why it's so much cheaper, because we're not burning so much energy to get it there so quickly.
That's true. Plus also, I mean, it's a small refrigerator size compared to an actual lunar capsule with 3 people in it.
Now, let's get back to asteroids. Now, as you said before, they could be our doom, but they also could be a source of a lot of fantastic resources. Let's start with the positive. And we've touched on this before. We've touched on this before in terms of some of the things we might be able to get off asteroids. And you even talked a bit about some of the projects involved in people trying to land on asteroids and come back with a little bit of an asteroid. Where are we at the moment in terms of that technology? What's the latest, Emmeline?
Yeah, so I guess maybe one thing to point out, though, which is, I mean, the reason why we think it would be great resource, even though if you can think about, the placement of the asteroid belt, it's much further than, let's say, the moon or Mars. And most people would say that why go? Because it's like it's too far and it's probably much harder to get to. But actually, thinking about the energy that it takes to get to one of these asteroids that would be good for resources, the delta V, or the energy that's needed to get there, some of them is actually much easier energy-wise than going to the moon. So that's one thing actually that I didn't even realize before. And the reason for that is, I think I mentioned before, that every time that we come out of a planet or an actual celestial body, we're coming out of a gravity well. And so it takes amount of energy to get out of, from Earth to Leo, or from the moon back up, or even Mars. But in terms of asteroids, because they're so small, if you, let's say, take the resources to get out of that asteroid, it's almost zero energy. So that's one thing I wanted to point out. And then the other things as well is that in terms of asteroids, there's different types of asteroids. There's the carbonaceous ones, which are actually 3/4 of the asteroids at the moment are carbonaceous. And so they're rich in water and oxygen and nitrogen as well, which are needed. And then the metal asteroids are very abundant in like silicon, iron, platinum, titanium, all of the things that we kind of like need or that we use so much as well here on Earth. Today, there are companies that are actually looking to mining asteroids. And as I mentioned before, I think, Luxembourg is sort of a country that is very interested in this particular kind of like niche industry.
Yeah, you talked about this last time we were on Luxembourg's place in the space race.
And then there were, about 10 years ago, there was several companies like Planetary Resources and Deep Space Industries. I mean, unfortunately, like right now, they've been acquired by other bigger companies, but they were focused on, for one, looking at which asteroids are the best candidates. So that's sort of like one thing that they've been looking at. There are also companies like Astroforge, based in California, that is looking at the technology to process materials if you actually get to an asteroid. Then there are companies that have landers and rovers that are mostly focused on going to the moon, but at the same time, it's the same technology that can be used to actually land on an asteroid. Companies like iSpace from Japan, and then there's like Cirrus Robotics as well, that's based in the US.
Would we be using the materials from asteroids for stuff we want to build in space for space, or bringing stuff back to Earth and dropping it down to Earth?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think there's a potential for both. For sure, to be able to build big structures like settlements in space and bigger space stations, the best way is really not to bring up or launch materials from Earth to construct them. It's better to get them from somewhere where you don't need to get out of the gravity well. Also, another study shows that the energy to get materials from in space, kind of either to LEO or to GEO, or maybe even down to Earth, is much smaller.
Sorry, LEO and GEO. What are those?
Low Earth orbit.
Okay. And GEO is geostationary orbit?
Right. And so the energy that's needed to get to those places, which we normally need for, you know, our satellites and spacecraft, the energy is actually much smaller than if you were launching them up from the Earth.
I can see, Emmeline, one advantage in processing, if we are able to develop the technology, things like iron ore into steel in space, or maybe some new variant on concrete in space, mm-hmm. because the greenhouse gases released by the manufacturer in space aren't going to heat up our atmosphere. And that would be handy, as long as when we drop these things down to Earth, the friction and the heat that creates and whatever doesn't then disturb our atmosphere too much. The other danger is that the payload will burn up on entry into the Earth's atmosphere. We've got to work a way of getting it down to Earth without losing most of it.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and you're right. But again, I'm more positive to think that we also will be able to figure out with new technology how that's going to come about.
All right, let's move on to the dark side of asteroids. The fact that if they're big enough, they can cause a lot of trouble. Yeah, but there's a reason for that. There's a method to my madness here, Emmeline. Trust me on this one. So we know that if something is big enough, it can really muck the Earth up, muck up the atmosphere. And there's no guarantee that at some point there isn't an asteroid somewhere out there with our number on it. Now, if we spot them soon enough, don't we have the technology even now to maybe, if we get out to them in time, we can slowly move, change their direction so that they don't hit Earth? It's just a matter of spotting them in time.
So there are several ways to potentially deflect an asteroid. One is, direct impact. Which you've seen in movies.
But that just goes down to make lots of little asteroids, which will still be rather big.
Yeah, so yeah, it definitely depends on the consistency of the asteroid.
I mean, imagine this, Emmeline. We blow up something which is, 12 kilometers across. That's the good news. We've blown it up. The bad news is we now have 200 Tunguska-sized asteroids heading towards Earth. 200 of them.
Right.
And, you know, one of them's going to hit a city, right? 12 megaton blast, bang, bang.
So, yeah, the option there is either you only do it because you don't want the extinction as opposed to having a devastation of multi-cities. So that's the reason why you do an impact. The other technique that they have is fairly similar, kind of like nuclear detonation, where you detonate either near the asteroid or on the surface so that you don't break it up. You basically just nudge it. Yeah, this is theoretical. It hasn't been done before. Although the impact one, there has been back in 2005, there was a mission called Deep Impact where they did impacted an asteroid, and it was a small spacecraft. And so that's one example of an impact.
How did that go, by the way, that exercise, Deep Impact?
I think it was inconclusive about whether they actually changed the orbit or direction of the comet. So the other ones is just nudging by detonation, not on the actual asteroid. And then the other one is more gravity traction. And it takes a longer period of time. Basically, what that means is that even if you have a small spacecraft that just flies next to an asteroid and stays there for a while, it could potentially over, you know, years be able to influence the gravity of that spacecraft, influences the orbit of the asteroid, that it would be enough to change its trajectory.
The problem is, Emmeline, that we don't spot these things that are heading for us in time to be able to carry out either of those options. How good are we at spotting things coming towards us now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So right now, there are robot telescopes or big robot telescopes around the world. And they, you know, there's ones in California, Hawaii, and so forth. And the way that they observe is that if one telescope observes one, it needs to be verified kind of in different parts of the world, which is actually why, for example, if Hawaii spots potential asteroid, it needs to be verified further along the line. And the next big telescope is actually New Zealand. The telescope up in Mount St. John is pretty important. We have like two, I guess now very famous asteroid scientists.
I was wondering if one of them was Alan Gilmore, because he's our regular astronomer. He used to be superintendent at Mount John. And I'm sure one of the things he often talks about is asteroid spotting.
So for 50 years, they've been actually determining orbits of asteroids. And I think they've discovered about 40 asteroid orbits over time, which is why it's very important. And so once those data have been verified, the Minor Planet Center in Massachusetts and NASA basically projects the orbits of these asteroids over the next 100 years to basically check whether they're on a collision course with Earth.
Is there anything due to collide with us in the next century, Emmeline, that I need to know about?
Not right now. So basically, there's about 1.9 million kind of like asteroids in the asteroid belt that's greater than a kilometer. Today, we've cataloged about 30,000 near-Earth objects. So those are ones where the asteroids, their orbits crosses the Earth's orbit at a certain period of time. But the issue here is that we don't know all of them yet. We have a pretty good idea of the big ones, the planet killers, but for those that are less than 100 meters, we have less than 10% that we know of. This is a global grand challenge that is essentially pretty much ignored, but has the potential to really be devastating. But at the same time, though, unlike other global grand challenges, we could have the technology to really do something about it.
Well, there are a couple of things to close, Emmeline. One is, and this is the reason I wanted to talk about the bad after the good, one is that we just have to get better at spotting them, and then we'll work out a technology that if we spot them in time, we can nudge them out of the trajectory which would have them crash into us. The other is that actually we cannot be 100% certain that we'll be able to do that, and we need a plan B for humanity. And that's where all the stuff that we're mining in asteroids could come in handy by setting up bases, either cities in space or maybe on the moon, where we can go and shelter while the Earth recovers from being smacked into by a planet killer.
Yeah, you're totally right. It is both, really, and which is why they're fascinating.
It's inevitable that at some point, isn't something big going to crash into Earth? It's just a matter of time, isn't it? We certainly can't rule that out, can we, Emmeline?
It is a matter of time because, there's also studies on this where the big planet killers, they normally come, there's only like three or four of them, but that we know, and they come like potentially, but the probability is about 130 million every 130 million years. The ones that are just like the Tunguska one comes like every 200 years. And then the smaller ones, just like the, if you remember the 2013, there was the Chelyabinsk.
That's right. Over Russia, yes.
In Russia, yeah. So that one's a 20-meter one, and that could potentially be coming every 60 years. So yeah, this is inevitable. So, which is why I think we definitely need to do planetary defense and develop the technology to be able to deflect or do something about it. And then also develop the technology to be able to actually use the resources for us for the future.
Emmeline, it's been fascinating talking to you again. Thanks so much for your time tonight and happy Asteroid Day, what's left of it.
Thank you.
Let's hope it's just a shooting star we see tonight. And make a wish on nothing any bigger.
Thanks so much.